wasn't very many weeks ago that I was listening to the O'Reilly Factor, and he was talking about a policy group that was going to doing a new poll. And this poll was that they were trying to get answers to, yes or no, but the poll was, how do you rate God's performance? And so they were questioning whether or not God was doing a good job in today's society. And so they made the poll, and the answers came back. Thankfully, at least 52% said that they thought he was doing a good job. 52% thought God was doing a good job. 40% said they really didn't know whether God was doing a good job or not, which leaves 8% of our society, that at least the ones they were polling, only 8% actually thought that God was doing a good job in whatever his job is. Okay. But the thing about it that I thought about was, we had reached a new low in our respect for God, in our understanding of who God is, that we would even dare and have the audacity to rate God in his performance. It's utterly ridiculous that you could think back a few years ago, how would we have even dared question whether God was doing a good job or not? I wouldn't even thought about it. And I was telling my wife, I wouldn't have dared answer the poll, because I wouldn't even dare think about questioning whether God knows what he's doing or not. The thing of it is, if you believe in God for being who God is, that all automatically means that you believe he knows what he's doing and that he is doing a good job. But it was just amazing. But we ought to think a little bit about that, and the subject I want to be talking about is, I will build my church, God says. Sometimes we may even question or not whether God really knows what he's doing in building his church. That we really believe that God can see and understand all of the various circumstances and the situations. But I think we need to start by understanding a little bit about God. Perhaps we ought to read what he says back here in the book of Job. In Job, when Job finally came to see that he couldn't question God anymore, that he had reached the stage to where he wasn't willing to sit down and argue with God the way he had said a little earlier. In one place in the book of Job, a few chapters earlier, Job actually, in paraphrase, he said, God, if you would come down here off of your throne and face me face to face in a debate, I could prove to you my point. But you can imagine how God took that, sitting on his throne in heaven. What he did actually was took Job at his word. And he did contend with Job face to face, didn't he? And brought him and confronted him with his whole attitude. And finally then, in Job 40, verses 1 to 5, Job said, moreover, the Lord answered Job and said, shall he that contends with the Almighty instruct him? Well, basically, that's what these people were saying in this poll, that we know better than God knows what a good job is in being God. Because we wouldn't allow some of the things God is allowing. Does that mean it's good, that what they would do? And bad what God is doing? But Job finally then he says, who are we to instruct him? And he that reproves God, let him answer it. And then Job answered the Lord and said, this is what all these people who answered that poll should have said. And Job answered the Lord and said, behold, I am a vile. I'm just a human being. What shall I answer you? But you know what? All of us at various times in our Christian lives, sometimes we think, well, does God really understand what I'm going through? Does God really feel my pain that I'm having? Does God really, is he really aware of all of the circumstances that are happening in my life? And whether we want to admit it or not, sometimes those thoughts creep into our minds, don't they? Well, is God really watching over me? Is he really aware of the things that are going on? What we should say is, behold, I am vile, and what shall I answer you? I will lay mine hand upon my mouth. When it comes to our judging of God, we want to clap the hand over our mouth and shut up, right? We have no room to argue with God. It says, once have I spoken, but I will not answer. Yes, twice, but I will proceed no further. Because Job was confronted by God, and God told him, he said, Job, look around a little bit. See what's going on. Over in chapter 40 of the book of Isaiah, we can read also in Isaiah, the 40th chapter. Where he says in Isaiah 40, in verse 25 to 28, he says, to whom then will you liken me, or shall I be? Says the Holy One. But we have a society today. My daughter was telling us that they were watching a Discovery program on Discovery Channel. And this scientist came on there the other day, and he was talking about scientific breakthroughs and how much they now understand and how they see how creation took place, and they can understand how all these things were formed. And he made the statement, and my daughter was flabbergasted, but he made the statement, he said, we are past the point of needing God. Because we can understand what has happened. We understand how the universe was made, and we understand how all of these various laws were put into motion. And we don't need God as a fallback on. Because we're smart now. And I was on Discovery Channel. But more and more, man is becoming free to rate and judge God, right? For what he's doing. And God goes on here in Isaiah 40, where he says in verse 25 to 28, lift up your eyes on high. And behold, who has created these things that bring out their host by number? And he calls them all by names, by the greatness of his might. Well, I dare say there isn't a scientist alive today who knows the name of every star and every galaxy and every part of the heavenly constellations. That they don't call them all by name, do they? And yet they are willing to equate themselves and compare themselves with God. That we now know a little bit, and all they see is a tiny little bit into what is going on and how God made man and how he made the universe. And now they're, as Isaiah late earlier had said, that the pot is telling the potter, why did you make me this way? Why are you doing this? But God says he calls every one of them by name. Man doesn't even know how many are out there yet. He doesn't know how many stars and how many universes actually there are. Because every time they get a bigger telescope and look a little farther, they're amazed that it goes farther than that. It keeps going. But these, some of you scientists can think we're past the need for God. Well, I wanted to just open up the subject with God because we are a part of the body, the church of God. A church that God is building. Or in the book of Matthew, Matthew chapter 16 and verse 18, Christ made a statement here in Matthew 16 and verse 18. It says, "And I say unto you, you are Peter." And he was referring to Peter as a little pebble. "And upon this rock I will build my church." Talking about himself. He is the rock in the Old Testament. He is the rock in the New Testament. He is the foundational stone. And from that moment when Christ, or actually before, Christ made this statement, from the time Christ was born, he has been in the process of building. And the word building refers to a construction process, right? Erecting of a building. Laying the foundation, putting up all of the walls and the other parts of the building until it finally is finished. From the time Christ came, he has been building and is still building his church with us, with you and with me. He is a designer, he's an architect, he is a construction being who builds things. He started with his disciples. And he has been in the process of building his church. I want to look at a couple of other examples. When Jesus tells us that he will build his church, we have a couple of other examples in the Old Testament of God as a builder and designer, and how he thinks and how he does things. So we want to look at the example of the construction of his tabernacle in the wilderness and the details that he goes through. God is a detailed God. And this all has to do with what the church is doing today. You realize that there are 50 plus chapters in the Bible. Not the whole chapter, but 50 plus chapters that in part or wholly deal with the building of the tabernacle in the Old Testament in the wilderness and all of the things surrounding it, how it was to be designed, how it was to be made, where everything was to go, and all of the intricate details of the workmanship and everything else, that you have 50 plus chapters out of this little book called the Bible that deals with the building of that tabernacle in the Old Testament. Well, that's a lot of detail, isn't it? A lot of information about how it was to be done. And they give detailed dimensions and specifics about how to build the tabernacle. Because God was the author of it. He was the architect. I used to work for an architectural firm there in California as a project man. And architects like things done their way. Okay? If they design something, they want it done that way. Right? Well, God is an architect. And he wants it done the way he says he wants it done. Let's go back to Exodus chapter 26 for a moment. In Exodus 26 chapter. And I'm not going to read in very much of any of the details because... But it is a fabulous study. Just to kind of let soak in how he designed and how he brought about this tent. Basically what it was, a tent in the Old Testament. and how it was to be designed. But in Exodus chapter 26, Exodus the 26th chapter, from chapter 26 through chapter 28, God gives the details and the instructions and all of the information regarding his temple and his tabernacle that he was going to be building. But in verse 1 of chapter 26, he said, "Moreover, thou shalt make the tabernacle with 10 curtains of fine twined linen, blue and purple and scarlet." You know, he wanted it a certain color by intertwining three basic colors together and bringing them about so that they produced a certain color. So you had fine twined linen and blue and purple and scarlet with cherubim of cunning work. You shall make them. The length of one curtain shall be 8 and 20 cubits. The breadth of one cubit, 4 cubits. And every one of the curtains shall have one measure. And the 5 curtains shall be coupled together. And he gives all of these details about verse 4, about making loops on the blue upon the edge of the one curtain, how they were going to interlock them so that they were connected one to the other. And he goes through all of these other details about the tenons and about the sockets and other things. And then he comes on over chapter 27 and talks about the court of the tabernacle and talks about the lamp. And then chapter 28 deals with the garments for the priests. And he got so detailed as to tell the priests, "I want this garment to be so long, because they're going to be going up the stairs up to the altar, and I don't want them having their legs to show as they're going up the stairs." So the garment was to be long enough so it wouldn't show. God is pretty detailed, you know, about what he wanted. And he was so detailed that he said, "You make it out of linen because I don't want the smell of sweat in my presence. If you make things out of wool, they tend to have much more of heat. Now, we don't use linen a lot today, do we? Tablecloths, you know, are made out of linen and some like napkins and things like that, but we don't use a lot of linen in our equipment, in our clothing. But God says, "I am not going to allow my servants to have the kind of material that leads to them having their sweaty underarms around," right? I'm not going to do it. And he thought about this long before it actually came into being and knew what he wanted. So chapter 28 deals with all of these things and goes on in detail about all these things. Over in Exodus 35, how much did he want it done right? In Exodus 35 and beginning of verse 30, Exodus 35 verse 30, it says, "And Moses said unto the children of Israel, See, the Lord has called by name." Here he had already picked out 2 individuals out of all of the tribes of Israel. Before this ever got started, he already had selected the people who were going to do the building. He'd looked out on Dan, Naphtali, Zebulun, all of the rest of the 12 tribes, and he chose 2 men out of all of them. One of them was a Jew, and one is a Danite, out of all the tribes, to build this material. And he says here in verse, in chapter 35, verse 30, "And Moses said to the children of Israel, See, the Lord hath called by name Bezaleel, the son of Uri, the son of Hur, of the tribe of Judah." See, we don't sometimes think details really make much difference, right? We don't have to worry too much about the small details. God isn't a perfectionist. Oh, isn't he? God is a perfectionist. You know that? He believes in perfection. Thankfully, he overlooks our imperfections in a lot of cases and forgives us. But he is a perfectionist. And he has filled him with the Spirit of God in wisdom and in understanding and in knowledge and in all manner of workmanship, that God's Spirit can give people the ability to make beautiful things. That's a gift. Inspired by God's Spirit. And to devise curious works and to work in gold and in silver and in brass and in the cutting of stones and to set them and in carving of wood and to make any manner of cunning work. And he has put in his heart that he may teach both he and Aholiab. See, God is the teacher. He taught Bezaleel and he taught Aholiab. He says very clearly that he had put in his heart that he may teach both he and Aholiab, the son of Ahisamach of the tribe of Dan. And them has he filled with wisdom of heart to work all manner of work of the engraver and of the cunning workman and of the embroiderer in blue and in purple and in scarlet and in fine linen and of the weaver, even of them that do any work. And of those that devise cunning the work. And then in chapter 36, verse 1, and so it says, then brought Bezaleel and Aholiab and every wise-hearted man in whom the Lord put wisdom and understanding to know how to work all manner of work for the service of the sanctuary according to all that the Lord had commanded. Point is God was this detailed about building a tent in the wilderness. How much do you think he is concerned about building his church? About his body, his church today? Is he concerned about you and me? Is he filling us with that wisdom of how we can build beautiful things and be a part of that body of understanding? So God spent a lot of time about the tabernacle. What about the temple when God was going to have the temple built in the days of David and in Solomon's time? Let's go over to the book of First Chronicles. In the book of First Chronicles, if I read the amount of gold and silver that he used in these things, I just stand in awe of how much and how rich this building must have been. Absolutely beyond anything we've ever seen. It'd probably make the Taj Mahal look like nothing, you know. It was a beautiful, beautiful building. But in 1 Chronicles chapter 22, we read here that God had inspired David and led him to want to build this building. And so in 1 Chronicles 22, in verses 1 to 5, then David said, this is the house of the Lord God, and this is the altar of the burnt offering for Israel. This is no ordinary house we're building. This is where God's temple is. This is where God himself is going to be sitting. This is where we're going to be performing the sacrifices to this God. The altar of the burnt offering. And David commanded to gather together the strangers that were in the land of Israel. And he set masons to hew wrought stones to build the house of God. And David prepared iron in abundance for the nails and for the doors of the gates and for the joinings, and brass in abundance without weight. And he also had cedar trees in abundance for the Sidonians, and they of Tyre brought much cedar wood to David. And David said, Solomon, my son, is young and tender, and the house that is to be builded for the Lord must be exceeding magnificent, of frame and of glory throughout all countries. David's attitude was, this is going to be the showcase of God to all the nations around. And people looked to it. If you want to read some archaeological materials, they will tell you that it was the height and the heyday of Israel during the time when the temple was there during Solomon's time. A beautiful, beautiful building. He said, I don't agree necessarily with, I remember a few years ago, the thing that seemed to be common was that people judged Mr. Armstrong for building the building, the auditorium, that he considered to be a house for God. They thought, well, he spent too much money on it. Could be. I don't know. I'm not here to judge that, one way or the other. But I do know, because I sat and listened to Mr. Armstrong say over and over and over again in those days, this is a house of God. And it must represent our attitude toward God. And that's why he spent so much time and money and the perfection that went into that building. Because it was to picture our relationship to God. And over the years, I have observed in myself, as well as in others, that to the degree that we seek God and fear God in our lives will be to the degree that you perfect your lives through God's help. It will be to that degree that we grow. Our fear of God, our honor of God, our desire to see God's building perfect the way he wants it. And so David gave all these instructions, and that it was to be built, it was to be exceeding magnificent of frame and glory throughout all of the countries. I will therefore now make preparation for it. And so David prepared abundantly before his death. He took all of his personal riches, his fortunes, and gave it to a special fund for the building of the temple. Everything he had, pretty well. Millions and millions of dollars that he put into building that building. And then all of the other stuff that Solomon put into it also, a little later on. Go back to 1 Kings chapter 6. I'm always amazed when I read this chapter, because I grew up around a construction family. My dad was a carpenter. He was a Finnish carpenter. He believed in doing things very well that way. He was a perfectionist in what he did. When he built cabinetry and he had miters, they fit. Not like when I go into houses nowadays and you see a lot of the miters, they don't fit, right? It's got big cracks. Talking to a construction man in one of the churches one time, said, yeah, we use a lot of wood filler. Well, you shouldn't have to use a lot of wood filler if you're doing a good job. And God is a perfectionist, and he likes it done good, really well. And so my dad was that kind of a bringer. And I grew up around heavy equipment. I spent one whole year up in Montana building roads on a big bulldozer. And these weren't just regular roads, they were mining roads. And I remember getting up there one time, and I was building a road right on the side of this mountain, and you look down, and it's about 1,000 feet drop, straight down. Well, not straight, but it was steep enough to where I didn't want to go over the edge. And so you make sure that you're on safe footing. Don't get too far out there until you get the road done. But it was noisy. When I was working with that dozer, I remember at times by the end of the night, because I was breathing all of this diesel fume in, that my throat was so swollen that I could barely breathe by the end of the day from breathing that diesel fumes. And it was noisy, and it was stinky, and it was smelling. And so when God describes the building site for his temple, I'm amazed. Because he says here in 1 Kings chapter 6, I'll pick it up in verse 7. And the house, this is the temple, the house of God, which is only a type of you and me, by the way, of the house of God today that God is building. And so when the house, when it was in the building process, it was built of stone made ready before it was brought thither, so that there was neither hammer nor axe nor any tool of iron heard in the house while it was being built. I've never been in that kind of a construction site where you don't hear a jackhammer going 90 miles, blasting your ears off. Or the roar of a diesel engine that you have to put earplugs in, or blasting the rock away. Or even a hammer. Because it was all done way out there in the quarries. These are those masons that David had got that he sent out into these areas to quarry the rocks. And they had chiseled them all out, and they had hewn the rocks out for the foundation stones of the temple. So that when they came to the temple site in Mount Zion, they were all done. They were all prepared ahead of time to fit in the construction of the temple. So that they didn't have to, this one isn't going to work. Throw this one away, and let's get a different one, right? They would all fit. Now, exactly how they did that, whether they had them all numbered, which they could have had, that this one goes here, and this one goes next to it, and they had them all fit. Because if you look back at the old temple when it was constructed, they were so fit so well that in some cases you couldn't even get a thin sheet of paper between them. They were that well developed and that well constructed. Well, I hope this is conjuring up in your mind what God is doing today. Because you're those blocks or crackpots or whatever else we are, right? Let me read a story in a little while here. The reason I mentioned crackpot. But what God is doing today, we're in the quarry, as so to speak, called his church today, right? His congregation. What we're in this church to be doing is allowing God, the true mason, to finish you so you fit where you're supposed to fit. And only God knows where you're supposed to fit. I don't know. And you don't know. And you may be fitting next to a person that you don't really want to fit next to for all the rest of eternity. I was in one area one time to where this one person did not want to ever wash the feet of one of the other members. That they just didn't want to have to wash each other's feet. And you think, maybe God's going to put them next to each other for all eternity. Well, they're going to change their attitude before they get there, right? Obviously. And so he says here, and the house when it was in the building, there was was being built of stones that had already been made ready before it was brought thither, so that there was neither hammer nor axe, nor any tool of iron heard in the house while it was in building. And the door for the middle chamber was in the right side of the house, and so on. He goes on through the rest of the way through there. But that always intrigued me, that as a member in God's church, what God is doing to me today is fine-tuning, finely chiseling all the excess off so that I will fit flat against the man next to me, so that whatever he wants to build, that it's very finely done. He's a perfectionist. He's not going to leave all kinds of gaps. And so he is working with us. So if God was so careful and he was so meticulous about his tabernacle, he was so meticulous about his temple, do you not think he might be a little meticulous and careful about the construction of his church, the church that he said he was building? Does it make any sense that God is building his church today in any less meticulous and professional way? That just doesn't make sense, does it, in any way? So let's read a couple of scriptures over here in the New Testament. In 1 Corinthians, first of all, chapter 3. 1 Corinthians, the third chapter. And every one of us has a part to play in this building. There is nobody that God calls to be a member in his church that has nothing to contribute. There is nobody like that. Every single one has something to offer in this perfect building that God is building. So in 1 Corinthians chapter 3, verse 9, it says, "For we are laborers together with God. You are God's husbandry. You are God's building. According to the grace of God, which is given unto me as a wise master builder, I have laid the foundation, and another builds thereon. But let every man take heed how he builds thereupon. For other foundation can no man lay than that is laid, which is Jesus Christ. Now if any man build upon this foundation gold, silver, precious stones, wood, hay, or stubble, every man's work shall be made manifest, for the day shall declare it." Then coming down, verse 14, "If any man's work abide, which he has built thereupon, he shall receive a reward. And if any man's work shall be burned, he shall suffer loss. But he himself shall be saved, yet so as by fire." See, God hadn't finished the job yet, had he? Verse 16, "Know you not that you are the temple of God?" We are those building blocks, the temple of God. "And that the Spirit of God dwells in you. And if any man defile the temple of God, him shall God destroy. For the temple of God is holy, which temple you are." Like, I couldn't believe that anybody would dare question God and rate God's job performance. Neither do I think that any of us should be willing to judge God's workmanship and what he's doing with each other. We can't do that either. Over in 2 Corinthians chapter 6. Again, he says in verse 16, "And what agreement has the temple of God with idols? For you are the temple of the living God. And God said, I will dwell in them, and they will walk in them, and I will be their God, and they shall be my people. Wherefore, come out from among them, and be you separate, says the Lord, and touch not the unclean thing, and I will receive you, and I will be a father to you, and you shall be my sons and daughters, says the Lord Almighty." We are that temple. Over in 1 Peter, He even goes a little farther in 1 Peter and chapter 2 and verse 4, where he says, to whom coming as unto a living stone, disallowed indeed of men, but chosen of God and precious, you also as living, or lively as it says in some Bibles, but as living stones are built up into a spiritual house, a holy priesthood, to offer up spiritual sacrifices acceptable to God by Jesus Christ. And then coming on down to verse 9, but you are a chosen generation, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a peculiar people, that you should show forth the praises of him who has called you out of darkness into his marvelous light. So we are that temple. We are that building of God that he is in the process of building. It's not done yet. It's still being done. Still being built. He's still working with all of us. So how carefully then is he building this spiritual house? Over in Ephesians, or back a few pages into Ephesians chapter 2. In verse 19 to 22. He says, now therefore you are no more strangers and foreigners, but fellow citizens with the saints and of the household of God. And are built, or as the Greek actually says, and are being built upon the foundation of the apostles and the prophets, and Jesus Christ himself being the chief cornerstone, in whom all the building fitly framed together. As I said, it's fitly framed. It doesn't leave big gaping holes and big cracks that have to be filled with gunk, you know, or wood filler or something else that you can paint over. It fits because God made it fit, in whom all the building is fitly framed together, grows unto a holy temple, a holy temple in the Lord, in whom you also are being built together for a habitation of God. God's going to dwell among us in the building that he has constructed and designed and architecturally laid out and inspired the builders to build precisely or precisely. He's doing it. So coming on down then to Ephesians 4, over a couple of chapters, Ephesians 4, in verse 16. He says, from whom the whole body, he's using a slightly different analogy now, he's using a human body, but same principle applies. The whole body fitly joined together and compacted by that which every joint supplies, according to the effectual working in the measure of every part, makes increase of the body unto the edifying of itself in love. You know, there are no excess parts in the human body, right? Despite what some scientists will tell you. A few years ago, they said you didn't need your tonsils. So they used to take them out, you know, right, left, and center, right? Now they realize they did have a function. They didn't think you needed the appendix either, right? That was kind of a leftover relic of our earlier days. Now they realize that it's a very important organ in the body for the preventing of certain infections and other troubles. Or they think they can do away with this and get away with that, or any number of different things. But God knew what he was doing when he made it. Man just hasn't caught up with God yet. Don't know why he did it that way. And so we find here that we are built up into this body and that every part of it, every ligament. I don't know what I am. I don't know what you are. But if I am a tendon, I want to be the best tendon I can be, you know. Whatever it is. I'm not, hopefully not so arrogant to think that I'm one of the major parts of the body. I'm just glad to be a part of the body, all right? Whatever the function is that we can be. And let God build us and help us to fulfill what our requirements are. Coming on over then to 1 Corinthians chapter 12, I'm not going to read very much of this because I want to use a similar scripture in Romans, but in 1 Corinthians chapter 12, verses 1 to 31, you will read what Paul talks about, this body, and how we all are essential in the body, and we all have gifts, one of another, to serve one another, differing gifts, differing talents. But in Romans, going back a few more pages, in Romans chapter 12, he uses the same basic analogy, and he says in Romans 12 and verse 3, "For I say, though through the grace given unto me to every man that is among you, not to think of himself more highly than he ought to think, but to think soberly according as God has dealt to every man the measure of faith. For as we have many members in one body, and all members have not the same office, so we, being many, are one body in Christ, and every one member one of another." That we fit together. We edify one another. And then he goes on, he says, "Having then gifts differing according to the grace that's given to us, whether you have inspired speaking or prophecy according to the proportion of faith, or whether you're a servant and you minister, let him wait on his ministry. Or he that teaches on teaching." There are basically seven gifts that God enumerates here. In differing ways, they all perform differing jobs, and they all contribute to one another that we might grow and develop. We all have a unique position in the body or in the temple of God. Again, what I'm saying is that if God was so careful in building the tabernacle in the wilderness, and he was so careful on building the temple of God in David and Solomon's time, how careful do you think he is in building his spiritual temple today? Building it together. Refining the stones, the living stones that would be built up into that temple, so that we will all fit, fitly framed together. Supplying whatever is needed. I want to end by reading a story. It's called The Crackpot Friend. Okay. And we probably all think, yeah, I got a few of them, all right? But the story gets a point across. It says, "An elderly Chinese woman had two large pots, and each hung on the ends of a pole which she carried across her neck." And we've all seen pictures of these Chinese or Indian people with a pole with a bucket on each end, and they were, and many a time, they were pots of ceramic pots made out of clay. And she would go down, one of the pots had a crack in it, while the other pot was perfect and always delivered a full portion of water. You go down to the water, you would like to come back with two full bodies of water, right? Two full pots. So at the end of the long walks from the stream to the house, the cracked pot arrived only half full. And for a full 2 years, this went on daily, with the woman bringing home only one and a half pots of water. And of course, the perfect pot was proud of its accomplishments, right? Thought, oh man, I deliver a full amount. I'm pretty good. But the poor cracked pot was ashamed of its own imperfection and miserable that it could only do half of what it had been made to do. So So after 2 years of what it perceived to be bitter failure, it spoke to the woman one day by the stream and said, I'm ashamed of myself because this crack in my side causes water to leak out all the way back to your house. And the old woman smiled. Did you notice that there are flowers on your side of the path, but not on the other pot's side? That's because I have always known about your flaw, so I planted flower seeds on your side of the path, and every day while we walk back, you water them. For 2 years, I have been able to pick these beautiful flowers to decorate the table. Without you being just the way you are, there would not be this beauty to grace the house. So each of us has our own unique flaw. As I say, some of us are crackpots, aren't we? And some of us aren't. I'm not sure who they are. But it's the cracks and the flaws that we each have that make our lives together so very interesting and rewarding. And that's what God is building together to construct his house. We've just got to take each person for what they are and look for the good in them. And so to all of my crackpot friends, have a great day. And remember to smell the flowers on your side of the path. Okay.